It is March the 30th, 2010, and you're listening to the weekly financial roundup with the Optimistic Bear. And this is the show where armchair economists rule the roost and pontificate on anything tangentially related to the economy and global finance. We don't claim to be experts on anything, but we sure enjoy talking about it. And we have our regular guests who usually join in, who are a little bit late right now, but we'll be having some people join us soon. And I'd like to let all of our many listeners out there know that we love to hear from you. So call in at any time, and the number is area code 917-388-4810. Let us know what's on your mind with economics or finance. What do you think is happening in the coming year? What's ahead? And what do you think about what's happened? And what does this mean for everyone, for all of us as individuals, to our financial futures? Welcome. Who's joined us?
Hi, Michael. This is Elliot.
Welcome, Elliot. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. How are you doing this week?
Oh, we're doing fine.
All righty. Am I the only one who's joined you so far? Is anyone else there?
So far, it's us. Plenty of things to discuss, though.
Yep. That is definitely true. You know, one thing that I've been noticing. Sorry?
Go.
Yeah, one thing that I've been noticing, and I'm noticing it in myself, is a feeling of optimism and bullishness about the economy. Now, I say feeling because I can feel it in my gut now, even though my mind and my technically based mind knows that these are all signs of a rally that is maturing. Whether or not it goes on for a few more months or not, I am convinced it is going to end this year. We can go into that later. But the thing I did want to touch on was more just the emotional aspect of it. When you see the market and it moves up this persistently, and you read the news, which tends to be biased towards what the general public is feeling, which is a very, optimistic right now, or at least the news stations are. I don't know if every average Joe is, but the news definitely is. So they'll portray all sorts of economic data that may just be a tiny blip on the positive side, and they'll make it into something much bigger than it is. So when you're inundated by this kind of stuff every day, it is emotionally, compelling, I guess. It makes you feel good and feel bullish, and certainly the consensus among everyone that I know in my day-to-day life is that, 2008 was a strange, scary blip, but it's all over, and things are hunky-dory now. I'm curious. Are you getting that feeling as well? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, there's definitely a resurgent bullishness I hear from many friends and colleagues. Not everybody, mind you. There's also a certain skittishness. There are people out there who. A considerable number of people who aren't ready to completely believe yet, but there a lot of people are heaving a sigh of relief. And I do find it interesting, though. It's an interesting recovery in many areas. Like you look at stock prices and bonds. The Wall Street Journal just had a story saying that the bonds have had an epic comeback. Corporate bonds,
right.
And in
both bonds, sure I have.
and through Tuesday of this week, there's been 31.5 billion bonds issued in the month of March of junk bonds, no less, which breaks all previous records. So right. so that shows us, I mean, when junk bond sales are doing well, that shows a marked bullishness in society. On the other hand, I find it fascinating how hollow many aspects of the recovery are. You look at things like mortgage finance, and it's getting worse, and there's actually no recovery at all in private lending. And if anything, the government is picking up a bigger and bigger role in mortgage lending. So there's certain aspects of the financial system which are completely still broken, utterly broken, and yet we're seeing junk bonds taking off. So there's some really strange stuff going on.
Right. Yeah, I definitely, putting that emotional stuff aside, because that's just because I know that's not going to be useful in terms of determining what's next. But one thing that you pointed out that's very obvious to me is that there is a disconnect between what I'm seeing happening in financial markets versus what I'm seeing. And I'm not really a fundamentals guy, but if I'm looking at fundamentals, they're not quite matching up. You know, the housing market is barely moved, and although we have seen some recovery in various numbers, it's just the magnitude of the recovery in some numbers is so small compared to the magnitude of what we've seen in junk bonds and equities, the type of rally we've seen there, and commodities as well. So it just, you know, some people who do agree with me that I've talked to about this, who say, yeah, you're right, the economy really is still in shambles, the rationale they come up with is, well, you know, this is all liquidity driven, this is all because of the Fed and that type of thing. I don't really buy into that, but I do think there is a disconnect there.
Well, the hallmark, our listeners, of course, know that we're generally bears on this show, and I'm not about to break that old habit of mine. And that said, I this all reminds me of the hallmark of recessions and in fact depressions. Is that if there's right. one thing that is the hallmark of them is volatility. and even if you look back to the 1930s, that was one of the most volatile times in market history, where there were when you think of the Great Depression, everybody always thinks of the great crashes, right, and all the money
right.
that was lost. But what people don't realize is there were also some of history's greatest rallies
right.
during the Depression as well.
Absolutely. In fact, there's only one rally in the history of the data that compares to the current rally in terms of its swiftness. And can you guess what that rally is?
Was that 29 through 30?
Yeah, it was basically the first rally, which was the largest rally in that period, although we did have some other pretty large rallies during that great bear market. But after the 29 crash, we had a rebound that retraced 53%, and that's the second swiftest rally we've had in history, and this, I think, takes the cake now, but I think this is now retraced something like 55%. I mean, it depends which index you're looking at, but we're actually slightly above where that rally period went. But it looks, I guess what I'm saying is we're following that period like a script still since 2007, except it's a little bit in slow motion. The Great Depression era went a little more quickly. And as you probably agree, and from stuff we've been reading, but I don't want to go into too much detail, but we basically believe this is going to be slightly larger than that period. So it does make sense that it might be on a slightly slower time scale. So we might see bigger moves, but it's going to take longer for them to happen. I mean, the 2000 to 2007 period was just, it was a decade-long topping process, I think, for what we're going through now. So, you know, this is, it's it's not going to be as fast, I think, as that period in terms of how the whole thing plays out. Of course, on the opposite side of the coin, though, once it does turn over, and I am convinced at some point this year it is going to turn, I think the actual move down could actually be much faster than the 1930 to 1932 period. And I'm basing that on the fact that if you go back through history, we've had many, many credit bubbles, many deflationary depressions that resulted from credit implosions, and all of them, the swiftness of the decline was related to the magnitude of the bubble. The larger the bubble, the faster it actually resolves itself. So I think given that this is the largest bubble we've ever had in terms of, you know, amount of credit extended, it would make sense that this would also be one of the fastest moves. So it'll definitely be interesting. Yeah.
I'm not so sure about the speed. I agree that large bubbles lead to even greater and more dramatic downturns.
Right.
But I think that there's a case to be made if that's why the turn and the downturn itself is taking so long. But I'm not so sure that we will necessarily see that once the top is reached, we'll see the bottom reached extremely quickly. And I, to a certain extent, I think that the very size of this bubble that we've had, and I don't just mean a recent bubble with lasting a few years or in the 2000s. I'm talking almost a 40-year bubble in equities in the Western world. I think that on that basis, the downturn itself is going to have to take a long time to work its way out. And I know I really annoy some of our listeners when I keep mentioning this, but I really looked at Japan as an example of what could happen, right? They've been going through a prolonged recession for 20 years, not just it wasn't some quick thing. And I think that makes perfect sense because they had one of the largest bubbles in Japanese history and possibly human history up through their peak in 1989. And so
that is a great counterexample, because the stuff I was talking about in terms of the speed of the decline, the size of the bubble, is that's actually only relevant to U.S. history. That doesn't include in other countries. So that's actually a great counterexample of a pretty large bubble that did not just, you know, resolve itself rapidly. So.
Yeah, I'm not saying you're wrong, Elliot. I'm simply saying that, and I agree that the magnitude of what we may see of the downturn may be extraordinary. But on the other hand, it may not be fast. It could be a really long, grinding process with
right.
massive swings, with massive volatility, and this I firmly believe is that there's a high probability that we will see volatility exceed anything anyone has hitherto imagined.
Right. Well, I think the ultimate low I think is going to a long time away, and then even after that low, the economy is going to have trouble for a long time. I mean, look, after the Great Depression, it's not like things bounced back and it was, you know, anything like the roaring 20s all over again. You know, the unemployment was pretty high for a long time, inflation was pretty subdued for a long time, and the public, nobody invested a dime for the next 20, or it wasn't until, you know, the 50s or 60s that people started putting money in stocks again because they were so terrified of them for so long. So, yeah, you're right. I think the whole thing is going to take a long time. But whether or not it looks like Japan or whether it looks more like the Great Depression, where it's just one fairly swift event, the good news is the strategy for dealing with either environment is fairly similar in terms of just keeping yourself nice and safe and liquid, and renting if you can, and that sort of thing. And so that's the good news. But the one thing I did look at, which I'm thinking about in terms of why there might be a really swift move down this year, is because there is a 4-year cycle bottom that I always pay attention to. Now, the 4-year cycle just means a bottom. It doesn't mean a bottom of like huge importance necessarily, but it means some type of bottom will happen. If you look at 2006, which was the last 4-year cycle bottom, now that wasn't like a big V bottom because I wouldn't exactly call, 2005 to 6 a bear market, but it wasn't a bull market. It was a corrective move. You know, it was a trader might call that a breather or something, right? So in a sense, it was a bottom, really. Technically, it was a bottom. And then, of course, the market soared in 2007 up to new highs. So, and then you go back another 4 years, you get 2002. Of course, that was a huge bottom. And then 1998, which was another one of those breather bottoms before the market soared to a new high in 2000. And this four-year cycle is just very, very reliable if you go back in time. So it's puzzling to me because that would suggest some type of a bottom happening this year. And with the market still soaring, I'm wondering, like, if this 4-year cycle is going to fail this time, if it's not going to work, or if we're going to have some kind of a quick bottom in 2008, which would mean a quick panic in the markets and then the beginnings of another rally. So I really don't know what's going to happen, but I've definitely been pondering this 4-year cycle thing and how that's going to fit in. And maybe it'll just mark a temporary bottom. We'll have a brief rally there, and then things will keep going down. So who knows?
I continue to stand by my theory that the markets are optimized to have the maximum number of people lose the maximum amount of money. And
right.
So they will do whatever is necessary to fool the most people into making poor decisions with their money. And that it means both the bulls and the bears, just as we've been seeing now in the last couple of years. The volatility has really hurt everybody. And right now the bulls feel they're doing well, but if things go poorly again, the bulls are going to get creamed too. And so I think that part of this is any analogs that we point to, right? We point to what happened in 1930.
They never work.
They never work. And I think they never work precisely because they exist. Because there are people who watch for those things. And because people watch for those repetitive patterns, that therefore ensures that there will not be a repeat exactly of the way things happened before. Because that's the whole nature of markets, is to do whatever most of the people or a significant number of people think will happen, that is precisely what will not happen.
Right. It's the principle of maximum ruin is what the market adheres to. And I think, honestly, that's the only principle that I know of that the market never breaks. It's maximum ruin. A good example of this maximum ruin thing is I was actually talking to a friend of mine who does modeling for investment markets. So he used to work for these funds, and he would try to go in usually with computers, and they'd try to find something of some statistical significance that they could trade off of. And what they found was generally once something had shown up enough to seem reliable, oftentimes it wouldn't work anymore after that point. Or if a method became popular, it would dramatically reduce its effectiveness, and sometimes a few years later it would start to become unprofitable. And I'm not sure exactly the reason for this, but One small thing I can mention is if everybody tries to follow a similar system, right, then when you're buying and selling, you're going to be moving the market and you're going to be generating huge amounts of slippage as a result, and you're not going to perform the way you thought your system would perform. I mean, that's a minor example, but the principle of maximum ruin basically says that whatever method somebody uses can't be popular and right. That much we do know.
Yeah.
Well, so it's not surprising that something simple and seemingly reliable would stop, no longer work in the future, right? Because by then, enough people might have noticed it. So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, just think of it this way. If everybody, if 100% of investors are convinced that one particular stock is the perfect stock to buy, that stock will become overpriced. Because there will be absolutely nobody selling it, nobody going short, and there is no stock. There is absolutely no stock that deserves a price of infinity. Everything should have a value on it. And so it's very logical, actually, to see how it simply cannot be the case that there is anything that is perfect for everybody to invest in. And to invest in at any price and at any time or whatever. And so, therefore, the markets have to have some kind of equilibrium that brings things back into balance. And if everybody jumps on one side of the ship, the boat has to right itself somehow, or it's going to capsize. And so it's not some mystery of what's going on. It's actually a very natural it's a very understandable type of mechanism that's at work.
Right. Let me put it this way. If you go to play poker with your buddies, how many games have you come out where everybody got rich and they all bought Ferraris because you just kept making money from playing poker with each other? Now, that may sound a little sarcastic, but especially if you've ever watched real traders trading derivatives. Now, derivatives are obviously zero-sum games. Everyone knows that. For every winner, there's a loser. They're just contracts. They're just bets, really. And then there's a commission that's always paid. So plus you're paying for software and systems and blah, 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 you know, taxes. Once you throw it all together, it's actually deeply negative sum. It's not even zero-sum. So a game that's deeply negative sum means that most people have to lose the game, especially if you're going to read about that millionaire trader. All that money came from somewhere. It came from people losing. Now, I personally believe, and I could be wrong, I've read some things on both sides of the table, that the markets, for the most part, operate very similarly to the derivatives markets. So if you're buying stocks or bonds, it is mostly zero sum in terms of trading them or trying to invest with them. And I do realize that there is some economic value. If you buy a bond, you're putting that money in the hand of a company, and they could be producing value, which pays you the interest, or same thing with stocks. But I think most of that real value is represented through interest payments or dividends. I think that's where the real productive use of that capital comes out of the market. So I think the actual fluctuation of prices themselves is much more like futures and is basically a negative sum game. So when you sit back and think about it, that it's this negative sum game, and then you read this article about a hedge fund manager who's leveraged up on commodities 30-1, and everyone's piling in. And then you go read about how a pyramid scheme or a chain letter operates. I'm sure you're familiar with the chain letter where, send me $5 and send a copy of this letter to 20 people to have them send you $5 and give me a cut. You know, it's this whole thing. And the more people that get in, the more the people make who are already in. So the more people that invest in commodities, the more the prices of commodities are going up and the more everybody thinks they're making. But these schemes are doomed in the long run. They can go on for a long time, especially if people can keep leveraging and more people are investing. But they're always doomed, and the vast majority of people lose a lot of money. The people who really win are the hedge fund manager who can you know, skim off the top and not get harmed when it blows up. But they have to blow up. I mean, just like the chain letter, it's not possible for everyone to get rich without working. And it's such a fantasy for people to believe that. And it seems insane to me that people did believe that, and many people do believe that is possible. But in any event, I think that's my opinion. Most people don't agree with that. It's very unpopular, but I think if we do go through another big bear market, I think most people are going to lose a lot of money, and they might come around and start thinking more of the way that I think now. And they're going to probably decide it's best to try to get out of the investment game for the most part. Of course, ironically, that'll be at a bottom where it's a great time to buy stocks, but that's the way these cycles usually work.
So we have a birthday to celebrate this week. This is the 10th anniversary of the euro. Depending on how you count it, because of course there was the EMU even back in the 90s, and which itself had an interesting history with some countries leaving it and so on. But the euro has been there by I'd say the most common count for 10 years now, and it's survived longer than I thought it would. So hey. I guess they're doing something right.
Right. Yep. Of course, the euro hasn't been doing that well for the past few months. In fact, it was really the fall of the euro and resurgence in the dollar that has caught my attention a lot in terms of believing this rally's days are numbered. I mean, I was sort of surprised the rally continued in conjunction with such strength in the dollar, because we've had such a correlation, but it has held up. But nevertheless, the dollar, I think that's the only thing I can see right now. I'm looking around all kinds of stuff. The only thing I see that to me has a clear message is the dollar. I think it's the ultimate canary in the coal mine that's signaling, you know, trouble will be coming.
Well, back in 2008, when we really started to see stocks go south,
right.
What was happening to the dollar before the market started to turn?
Well, they all fell in different orders. I mean, back then, I think stocks led. And if you remember, stocks were collapsing and gold was skyrocketing and commodities were going up and everyone was piling back into commodities. And it wasn't until much later that they finally had their collapse, and oil had this huge collapse. And I think this time around, it's kind of the opposite is happening. The dollar is kicking off the whole thing. It's sort of the other way around, and then commodities, and then stocks will be the last thing to go. But this is actually similar to the rally, as I said before. It's another analogy, which I know, as we said, are kind of dangerous. But if you look back in the 1930s, that huge 53% retracement, the leaders on the downside there were not stocks. It was also the currency, which was measured in gold at the time, and commodities actually went down first. So that if the analogy holds up, it looks similar to what's happening right now, where we're starting to see some resurgence and deflationary pressures before the rally ends, which would actually be quite a nice analog to what happened then.
So should we be looking at the euro for another 10 years? Be planning for the 20th year to 20 year celebration?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, when you have big large depressions, that always spells the death knell for some currencies. I don't know which currencies are going to die, but usually some of them do, or not necessarily die, but at least fade away, like the pound did during the Great Depression when it lost its reserve currency status. So I definitely be wary of currencies, and the euro certainly looks like it has a lot of stress on it. So,
well, I am going to officially revise my prediction on the euro. And my prediction on the euro has been that it will collapse. And I never had a firm date on it, on exactly when that would be. But I always said that I didn't think it would survive. I'm going to revise my pronouncement.
So what does not survive mean? Does that mean there's a hyperinflation, or is it more like, didn't something happen in Iceland? Was it Iceland? Yeah, it was Iceland where they basically defaulted on all their debts, and then the rest of the world is not going to accept Icelandic currency. They basically just said, no, we're not going to take it. It's worthless to us. Now, I don't know if that was really a hyperinflation or more of just a rejection. And I'm wondering if we could see that with the euro, where people just are like, they just stop using it or lose faith in it. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I do agree with you that its days are numbered.
Well, but that's what I'm changing, actually, my prediction. I'm no longer going to say that the euro itself will disappear. What I am going to say, however, is that the countries that are members of the euro, and which countries we consider to be euro nations, may change. In fact, will change. So either way, the euro itself will disappear, or some of the countries that currently are in the euro will no longer be in the euro. And whether that's because they voluntarily leave or they are kicked out of the union, I don't know. And what will happen to the remaining nations and to the currency itself, I don't know either. I could see several things happening. I could see the euro remaining very strong, but some of the countries that leave find that the currency or that their currencies are extraordinarily weak. But it could even be the opposite. We could find that the euro becomes extremely weak, and the countries that leave the euro, relatively, their currencies are much better. I don't know. There's so many different permutations of things that could play themselves out in this grand game. I think it's difficult to say, but I feel safer in saying that what we think of as the euro won't exist.
Right. Yeah, I think you're probably right in terms of the current state of things won't exist. It won't be the same. But as to what form that failure or breakup would take, who knows? You know, maybe the euro survives, but a smaller subset of countries adopt it, and the other one finds a way to exchange their reserves for something else. Or, you know, it doesn't have to be some horrible disaster. It could be quite orderly. I mean, there's just so many things that could happen. It's hard to make that kind of a speculation.
Just a note to our listeners, feel free to call in, area code 917-388-4810. We'd love to hear from you and your thoughts on the economy and the euro.
Yeah.
And speaking of Europe, there is news from a number of places in Europe regarding some of the economic problems that have been going on. I noticed that Ireland now has announced that they are going to that many of their banks will require something near $32 billion, or actually no, 32 pounds in bailout, 32 billion pounds in bailout, which is pretty significant. In fact, I mean, the impression I have is that the entire Irish banking system is basically insolvent, and that it is simply de facto nationalized by the government. Which again just goes to show that problems haven't really been fixed. We're still finding this stuff out now.
They're just a bunch of band-aids that people have put on. And now that we've had this rally, which has re-liquidified things a little bit, everybody's partying, but the problem is still there, and it's gotten much more acute, I believe. And if this if the liquidities are moved, which I think could happen if we just see a downturn in bonds or rise in interest rates. In fact, if you've been watching Treasury bond auctions, you'll see that the rates have been ticking up quite a bit. And if you look at that compared to certain measures of inflation, which are very low, in real terms, those interest rates are actually getting pretty high. So I think that could put the brakes on some of this liquidity ultimately, which definitely doesn't have good implications for debtors, I don't think.
You mean higher interest rates would put the brakes on higher interest rates could hurt liquidity?
Well, it's kind of, you know, I feel like I'm going down this argument of a dog chasing its own tail, so it's hard to get anywhere. But when investors start demanding higher real interest rates, it makes it much more difficult for borrowers to keep making those payments, right? And so once they start showing increasing signs of stress there, then there's a downward spiral event could happen where they start demanding higher yields, and that increases the stress. I mean, ultimately, it's the investors who are really in control here in terms of whether or not a lot of debtors can remain solvent or not. You know, if they keep your rates low, you might be able to survive a bit longer, but if they put the vice grip on you, then you know, you're going to pop, and then they're going to notice that pop for sure and keep the vice tightening. But we've been seeing the opposite, you know. Those bonds are still holding up quite nicely now, so liquidity's still high. We'll see how long that can stay up.
Now, when you talk about bonds, what are you referring to? Are you referring to Treasury bonds, or are you talking about corporate?
I'm talking more about corporate. That's the thing I'm talking about. Corporate and junk, whatever you want to look at, those types of bonds have been rising. But there is a relationship to those in Treasuries, and when Treasuries go up, it can affect, it definitely affects mortgage rates. Mortgage rates can go up. And so I know there is some relationship there, but it's not something I've studied enough, but I do think that seeing those yields spiking is a little worrisome if you're very bullish on things.
Well, I'm still a little confused here because, well, as we were just talking about earlier, yields are actually fairly low on corporate bonds, and on junk bonds, they are much lower than they've been in several years for sure.
Right. But the important thing, I think, for the economy is not the actual yields, it's the real yields. That is, you have to subtract the underlying rate of inflation to figure out what they're paying in real terms. Because real terms relates to earnings power of equity, of stuff, of running a business and selling things that you produce, all that kind of stuff. So I think real yields are much more representative of how much stress debt causes on institutions. So that's why I think the numbers, even though they seem low, the stress levels might be higher than people are realizing, and seeing the rates move up in an environment of deflation, it could be troublesome. Now, if we weren't experiencing such a period of deflation, then I wouldn't really care that much to see rates move up. It would be meaningless. So does that make sense at all?
Somewhat. This is an area that's always confused me a bit, because if we had a scenario where it's hard for me to understand how there could be a scenario where the dollar appreciates relative to other currencies and relative to asset values, yet Treasury bonds decrease in value and yields go up. It's difficult for me to see that. But now, historically, is there any correlation between that? Have we seen does history show that there's no real correlation between Treasury bond yields and the strength of the dollar?
I don't think there's a consistent correlation you can watch on. You can watch, but there certainly have been periods of intense correlation. And those periods, I think, come when inflation is very high or very low, or are very negative, rather. Very high inflation, you'll see the currency fall, and you'll see bond yields go up dramatically when you have accelerating inflation, like in the 70s. And then in the 1930s, when we had an intense bout of deflation, we saw the currency go up dramatically, and we saw yields on bonds fall dramatically. But you know, the fact that yields are going up now, I think my personal belief is that I'm bearish on Treasury bonds for the short term, because I think while this rally is finishing up, we're going to see yields tick up because people are sort of disgusted with Treasury bonds, and the alternatives look great, like these junk bonds and corporates, because of the rally. But I think that's going to help put the brakes on things, and I think once this rally does end, I'm actually quite bullish on Treasury bonds because I think it'll be similar to 30s, and we'll see rates fall a lot. But that's just, you know, if I had to guess, that's what I'm thinking is going to happen. I don't know what's actually going to happen though, but that's just my best guess.
I noticed another news item that Japan announced that they had the 12th consecutive month of falling consumer prices, and that prices are now 1.2% lower than they were a year ago on a general basket of consumer goods in Japan. And there's comments from the finance minister saying that everyone in Japan needs to work to prevent this, to fight deflation. And I was almost it was almost making me think to the efforts in the United States in the 70s to stop inflation, right? It's almost like doing it in reverse. I wonder if they would consider
the win button.
Yeah.
Inflation now. They wanted you to go to the store and haggle for lower prices because that was what was going to stop inflation. It's so ridiculous. And they think they can do the same with deflation.
I suppose in deflation, the government should be asking people to insist to pay more when they go to the store. Don't accept right. those low prices. Demand your right to pay more.
Exactly. I'm sorry, I interrupted you there. What were you finishing up?
No, I made my point. I was just looking here. I was reading some of those comments for the Japanese finance minister, and I just thought it was very amusing hearing him talk about how everyone has a duty to fight deflation.
Right. Of course, -1.2, I mean, I don't know how severe their deflation's been in the past 20 years, but if you compare that to the U.S. and the Great Depression, that's small potatoes. That's nothing. And we had, like, double-digit deflation during those years, so you know that's real deflation.
Well, but there's deflation and deflation. It depends on what the basket of goods are that are being monitored, right?
Definitions of deflation, you mean?
Yes, and even right. in the Great Depression, some prices of some things never fell as much as others, and so. Like wages, many people's wages never fell 50% from what they had been. There were many careers. I mean, if someone had remained employed throughout the Great Depression for 10 years or so in the same job, very few people found themselves earning 50% less than what they'd been earning before. In fact, usually not. But there were many other – there. But if you looked at assets, prices, right? Assets, whether it's stocks or many other things, many assets fell by far more than 50% in price. So there, it really, and I think that in a deflation, we would see similar types of anomalies.
It's funny because the deflation, in my opinion, is nature's redistribution mechanism. Because if you look at the difference between the very rich versus the middle class, or basically everybody else. The main difference is that for the most part, everybody else has cash. That's what they use. They earn cash from their jobs. They spend cash on things. that they want, but they don't own, you know, a chain of 7-Elevens or something like that, like a lot of wealthy do. And so during a period of intense deflation, you actually get this dynamic where the middle class, those that remain employed, that is, will actually, you know, begin to enjoy a slightly a higher relative income to those who are asset rich. So there is a dynamic there. I think it's sort of nature's redistribution mechanism that should run its course, I think. But I don't know, the bailouts sort of put the plug on some of that, which I think, you know, stuff that was supposed to happen.
Yes, well, but as we've also discussed before, despite the fact that we may feel that things are not going to be particularly good in the economy, in the market, in the near term, that doesn't mean that we think that both the rallies or the crashes are due to devious manipulators who are behind the scenes making everything happen.
Yeah, I think that's ridiculous. You know, I think most people that talk about manipulation, the vast majority of them are frustrated traders. Because I've been there. I know what it's like when you're trading and you've lost money in some trades. The single most appealing thing psychologically is to find someone else to blame. And it's very difficult not to do that. But that's what people just have this burning desire to do. And when you can't find anything, then manipulation is a great backup thing to blame, that someone out there, you know, moved those prices and that was the cause of your trading loss. And I've been hearing this from so many people, and definitely in the rally I've been hearing it from people saying that it's the plunge protection team and they're the ones buying futures and pushing the market higher here. And I don't really believe that's true. I think we're just seeing a very unique period in history where we're seeing historical overvaluation that we've never seen, one of the swiftest rallies we've ever seen, you know, extreme optimism in the face of a faltering economy. And all of this is following the script of previous depressions. There's nothing weird or unusual going on at all. There's no reason to suggest it's manipulation. This is perfectly normal behavior, I think.
Well, I will actually say that I'm sure that that manipulators exist, and that there are people who do their level best to control the markets and move things one way or another through buying futures or otherwise. And some of these manipulators may very well be government policymakers. That said, I also believe that their ability to truly control things is limited. And maybe they could move things on the margin for some short period of time, but in the long run, I think, and long run isn't, I'm not saying decades or many years, but in a matter of weeks, I think it's difficult for them to really have an impact. It's possible that a given manipulator might, that the markets might be going in their direction for a period of time. I mean, the Hunt brothers had a great run for quite a while before they found that they were unable to control the silver market. And so, likewise, you could have some policymakers who are buying futures to try to keep the market stable. And lo and behold, for a year, the market seemed to be stabilizing, and they become very confident in their ability to manage things. But then there will come a day when it doesn't work, then they will realize that they were just kidding themselves as to why the markets were actually up for that period of time that they were working on it. And back to your point about how people want to believe it's convenient to blame losses or problems on manipulators, I I think that's partly true, but I also think that people want explanations for things. And it is a very, it's a very elegant and simple explanation to blame things that we don't like on some evildoer or someone who some
in the sky somewhere, Michael,
or some conspiracy that is that's making it happen, because that gives a rationale to it. At least there's somebody controlling something. In fact, I'll go this far. I think it is preferable to think there is somebody in control, even if they're doing something that's evil, than to think that nobody's in control of this god-awful mess.
Right.
I think that is scarier by far I think it's naturally then people are going to want to feel that the universe is contained and there's some kind of sense in it and there's some sort of control.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I think to an extent people blaming manipulators for large market trends are sort of like people blaming Poseidon when there's a storm out in the ocean or something. That's the way I see it. But yeah, I do agree with you. I'm pretty sure they do exist. And it is possible that they buy futures using our tax money, and they do this regularly. And maybe that would cause an intraday spike or something of that nature. But I just don't think they can change a large trend of a market. I mean, these markets they're worldwide with billions of people participating in them. So I don't think they can do to anything to that level. But an intraday, you know, little pop if they really wanted to do it, at you know when the trend is amenable to that, I would probably believe that. That's the most I'm willing to sort of believe from that.
It must be fun.
Yeah,
I wonder how can you get a job as one of those manipulators?
You start at Goldman Sachs as a front runner, and you work your way up that way, and then eventually Washington D.C. You know, you get some connections there, and I think that's basically how it works.
I'll have to look into that.
Yeah.
So,
I wanted to read a quick quote.
Go ahead.
As we've been talking about, you know, especially you and me, I feel very, very lonely being one of the remaining bears. although, yeah, one thing I've learned, which I did mention last week about tops being slow, because I was talking to this guy who's done a lot of trading, experience in the markets, and he basically said that, you know, if you see extreme overbought reading, the best strategy is to go to cash because the risk reward on the upside is not worth it. He says, but 9 times out of 10 you'll be wrong if you try to bet on the downside because tops are so excruciatingly slow. I think that's very applicable to what we're seeing now. If you've been bearish, you've been wrong, of course, thus far. But if you've been bullish, the upside since I think November is still only like 5 or 6% over that whole time period. So with the downside risk that is available, the risk reward is really not favorable at all for going long here. So it's important, I think, for bears to just relax, hang out, wait it out a bit more, and keep looking at the big picture, because I believe this decline is definitely coming. Nothing has really broken the pattern or anything like that. But here's one guy I read. His name is John Kaplan, who has had a couple good years here. And he wrote, basically, the shape of 2010-2012 is likely to closely resemble the bear market of 30 to 32. While the upside breakout in the S&P 500 is false, the upside breakout in the U.S. dollar index is true and significant. So whether or not he turns out to be right, that's definitely what I believe. You know, I'm sitting back looking at the big picture, and the dollar to me is the big, big thing I'm focusing on. With that thing in such a strong bullish trend, even though we're probably near a correction now, if this continues, I think this is going to be signaling further deflation in the future and everything that implies. So it's real important to look at, step back, relax, stop reading, you know, the crazy news, stop watching the market every day, stop worrying, look at that big picture, and it is going to unfold, and I think we'll know it when we see it starting. So that's my opinion.
Fascinating. So is there anything our listeners should be watching for this coming week? Any interesting announcements that we're expecting?
I don't know. I'm really almost not watching the markets now because, you know, I sort of know what I'm waiting for. Waiting for this dollar to relax a bit and then rev up for its next move, which I don't think the markets are going to be able to withstand. That's sort of what I'm waiting for, and you know, whatever the markets do before then is somewhat irrelevant because they're not going to have their big moves until the next moves in currencies also take place. So I'm not watching anything. I'm just relaxing. I'm just waiting for that up here.
Well, some, I haven't noticed it this week, but some newsletters that I read will periodically talk about how investors should be aware of certain movements of celestial bodies that are occurring in certain times and stuff.
Oh,
and so, who knows? Maybe there will be some kind of eclipse this coming week that has great portent that we ought to be concerned about. But if so, I unfortunately haven't been following the patterns of the stars to offer any insights tonight.
Right. I mean, if you look out there at newsletters, you will find a newsletter that uses me and every ridiculous thing you've ever heard of, and they'll all swear by it. I can't even tell you the number of like insane things I've seen where people try to make all these patterns with numbers. You know, astrology is popular. Or people will watch, you know, take a lot of stock in who's president, who's not. I guess that's not as ridiculous. I'm trying to think of the more ridiculous ones.
Well, did you ever see the movie Pi? And the gentleman who was, they even had people using the, trying to decode the Bible for doing mathematical equations,
right,
to try.
You know what it's like? It's like the Da Vinci Code applied to the stock market. That's what some of these newsletters can sometimes end up like.
Well, it's been another great hour, Elliot. Thanks for joining us, and thank you, listeners, for calling in. And
so next week, we got to see what Saturn's doing. We got to see
absolutely
what Saturn's doing.
Next week, we will have this celestial forecast for the economy. I will make a point of looking it up. And every Tuesday, 9 p.m. Pacific time, that's when we're live on the air, and we'd love to hear from our listeners. Just call in next week and tell us what you're thinking about the economy and what your friends are saying. We'd love to hear from you. And this has been another great week with the Optimistic Bear and Company.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
You're welcome. Bye.